The Honorable Chief Justice Perry Gary presiding.
Good morning.
Go ahead and be seated. All right, first matter we have up today is Mars versus Schiff. This is docket number 53601. And counsel, are you ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, did you want to reserve any time?
Yes, Your Honor, 5 minutes.
All right.
Your Honor, Matthew Sharp, and with me is Stephen Osborne on behalf of the plaintiff, Shirley Mars. And before I get into the substance of the argument, I have a handout of about 4 or 5 pages that I may be referring to through the course of argument. As I begin the argument, I mean, I think the essence of the issue is this. Does the statute of limitations begin to run on the date of legal injury, or is it such, as the defendants are proposing, that the statute literally runs before injury has occurred?
Well, didn't she, by her own characterization and her own testimony, didn't she indicate the injury occurred on May 19, 2000?
Well, no. Well, first of all, it would be 2 points. First, when you read the statute, and the second page of my handout is the statute, you have the 4-year statute beginning from the date of injury and the 2-year statute beginning from the date of discovery. In both Massey and Galoon, this court has held the injury under the statute is legal injury. Now, if you take the Hoops versus Hammergren case, which I think is the closest Nevada precedent that you have on this point, you have date of misdiagnosis in Hammergren in 1972, misdiagnosed with multiple sclerosis. Thereafter, there's a 5-year period of treatment during which the plaintiff is harmed in the sense that there's overdosing of drugs, sexual relations, all of this occurring during this 5-year period. But the court held in Hoops that the statute begins in 79. Why? Because that's when the plaintiff learned she didn't have MS, so that the injury requires knowledge. And it's the same thing here. The injury that Ms. Mars suffered all stems from the point that she learned she doesn't have cancer. Because everything up until that point is consistent with standard of care. There is no injury, and I would suggest the point being if, for example, on May 20th of 2000, Ms. Mars stood in front of this court and said, my case was dismissed because I have cancer and the doctors treated it, you would say there's no legally compensable injury.
But isn't that the purpose for the 2-year discovery aspect of the statute?
No, it isn't. And the point...
put another way, same question. Crediting your theory that it is not until she learned that she had been misdiagnosed that she sustained legal injury, then why have the 4-year piece of the statute and not just rely on the 2-year discovery rule?
In addressing both questions, I think essentially the same question, which is, I think, you know, obviously the gist of the defense argument. And I would say this, in certain instances, you may have injury tied to both. And that was recognized in Galoon when, in I believe, footnote 4, Galoon said, in a wrongful death situation, virtually every instance you will have discovery and injury occurring on the same date. Then you follow that up with the Day case where the court found that you can have injury in a wrongful death situation on a different date than the date of death. And so I would go back to the Hammergren case, which you have identical factual pattern, and the court only focused upon the 2-year statute. Why? Because in that instance, the date of injury was tied to discovery. Now you look at the California precedent that interprets the same statute that this court has recognized in Galoon as being at least persuasive authority, and you look at the Steingart case. And the Steingart is the instance where Ms. Steingart goes in for one visit from the doctor with a lump on her breast. The doctor misdiagnoses as being normal. Then many years later, past the four-year statute or three-year statute in California, she learns that it was breast cancer. The date of injury is the date she appreciates the harm due to the medical act, which is the date she learns she has cancer. And it's the same instance here. I mean, from the point of 2000 up until 2004, there's no knowledge, there's no injury, because the injury is tied to the knowledge of not having cancer, which is the harmful effect.
What about Go ahead.
Why not measure the statute from the last date of treatment rather than the date that she learned she had been misdiagnosed, if indeed she was?
Well, I think that could be a fair point, which would raise, I mean, one of the issues that I'd like to raise in my timeline is the point that I see, you know, the inconsistency with the defense point is, say, they're saying May 19th, that was your date of injury. Well, between May 19, 2000 on my chart till January 23, 2003, she's seen 43 times, which requires a separate diagnosis each time of metastatic cancer. On February 25, 2002, she has nearly dies from a blood clot in her superior vena cava due to the treatment by the defendants. Now, the rule that's being proposed by the defense says injury has already occurred before you know there's an injury. But what my point would be is, if you want predictability, I think you have to focus on something maybe as Your Honor suggests, from the date of last treatment, when you have ongoing treatment. But there has to be a harmful effect that the plaintiff has notice of in order to have injury. And so I would say, in our opinion, clearly that occurs on September 23, 2004, but at the very least, it's a question of fact as to when she has appreciable harm.
Mr.
I don't know if I addressed your question, but I hope I did.
Mr. Sharp,
yes.
In Judge Kosach's order, he states that Mrs. Mars failed to provide any evidence of concealment which would toll the applicable limitation period. How do you respond to that?
Well, I would point first to page 2 of my handout, which is the statute, and I highlighted the subsection 3, which is the concealment provision. And the key language that I would focus the court on is, through the use of reasonable diligence should have been known to the provider of health care. So the provider of health care has concealed any act, error, or omission which, through the use of reasonable diligence, should have been known to the provider of health care. So this is a point where our legislature has distinguished from California's law. We do not require actual fraud. The evidence that we have of knowledge on the part, or knowledge through reasonable diligence, is in part page 3 to our handout, which is from page 714 of the record, which is a CT scan done on April 25, 2002, where the radiologist notes that the lesion on the arm, which has stayed the same for 2 years, may represent a benign enchondroma rather than metastasis, or rather than cancer. This lesion appears to have been stable on bone scan for almost 2 years. And we're saying that's the point where, through reasonable diligence, they should have known they had misdiagnosed her. They knew they didn't get a biopsy to confirm the diagnosis as the standard requires. They now have a radiologist saying the lesion's stable for 2 years, it's likely not cancerous. And the answer to that is nothing. They don't disclose it to Mrs. Mars. They don't discuss it. They don't analyze it. So I would say, for at least that period of time, from April 25, 2002, to the point of cancer of September 25, 2004, you have a tolling of the statute, which would make
sense. So how did Judge Kosach respond to that very argument?
I don't think he did respond to it, because part of
the argument was made just that specifically.
Well, I think it was. I think the problem with Judge Kosach, which is the other aspect of our brief, is there, for whatever reason, was a bias stated in favor of the defense when he refers to the good doctors, when he personally challenges Shirley Mars on why she's filing suit in the first place, or if you don't want to be that devious, it's just simply he failed to follow the rules for a 50A motion, which is all facts should be interpreted in favor of Mrs. Mars. And when those facts are interpreted in our favor, you have evidence of concealment in a tolling period.
But this record and that argument was made to the court.
It was.
Prior to the finding that the case was not going to go to the jury, did you had you submitted jury instructions on things like concealment and the special interrogatory on when the injury occurred for the jury to make that determination? I don't know if you do that in Washington.
Your Honor, I don't recall if we. I don't believe we had not settled jury instructions. I just don't recall. I can find that answer out. I've got my 5 minutes.
You got your 5 minutes.
What I'd like to do is just sum up very quickly. I think the point here is we have longstanding precedent in this state defining injury to mean legal injury. In this particular case, given the facts, legal injury occurred when Mrs. Mars learned she didn't have cancer because her damages are tied to that fact. And this isn't an instance where we're saying the 2 and 4 years are the same. This is a unique factual pattern. And I would suggest the rule by the defense creates more problems than what our existing statute is, which is legal injury. And with that, I'll reserve my remaining four minutes.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Pony?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Tiffany Pony, and I represent the respondents, Dr. Schiff and Shields, in this case. And I would like to initially point out, as the court has recognized, and I think that Mr. Sharp and I actually agree on one thing, the spark that triggers the statute of limitations here is legal injury. Legal injury has been defined by this court in Massey as the negligence, the elements of negligence, and a manifestation of physical harm. I'll turn you to plaintiff's complaint in this case.
What is it, unneeded treatment, physical harm? Unneeded treatment. If you don't need a treatment, isn't that physical harm?
That's
and she
correct,
received
Your Honor.
Treatment.
That's correct. And also, if you look at the affidavit and the complaint, another harm that has been claimed in this case is the severe anxiety and depression that came along with this diagnosis of metastatic disease. And from May 19th forward, that's what they claim in their complaint on page 3 of 4, that on May 19th, defendants were negligent. That's the first prong of legal injury that they're claiming. They also claim that on May 19th, Ms. Mars was harmed. That's the second element of legal injury.
But so wasn't she harmed repeatedly each time she was subjected to cancer treatment that, if indeed she didn't have it, was inappropriate?
And that would have been part of the harm that they were seeking damages for. Yes, I'm not going to stand here and say she wasn't harmed at that time.
So the last time would have been roughly January 23rd, 2003, that would be the last harm, correct? When was her last cancer chemo treatment?
I would have to look back in the record, Your Honor. I know January 23rd was the last time she actually had a visit with Dr. Schiff and Shields.
Okay, let's assume for the sake of this discussion that she underwent chemotherapy on that date.
Correct.
Why wouldn't that separate injury be treated as as the start date for a claim based on at least that episode of chemotherapy?
Well, number one, because the Nevada legislature didn't carve that out as an exception to the medical malpractice statute. When they did carve out three exceptions, one of which is concealment, another of which is the foreign body, and I forget.
So you're treating that as a continuing treatment type of argument?
I'm saying that the legislature, we have to assume that they recognize that, and that was one of their considerations in this whole period while she's being treated by Dr. Schiff and Dr. Shields. They're treating her as if she has cancer. They know that she has a strong reoccurrence. This was not diagnosed, actually, by them. It was diagnosed, and she was treated for it before she even came to see them. They're trying to save her life here. They don't believe they ever misdiagnosed her. To date, they don't believe they misdiagnosed her.
Right. I understand that, but that's an issue of fact. So we're here on a Rule 50 motion. We have to accept their version of those facts, right?
Well, there's no evidence that they didn't believe that was true, so that's not a disputed fact.
Counsel, you talked about one of the exceptions. You said Nevada didn't carve out another exception, and that is concealment, which then takes us to the judgment and the finding that there was no evidence of concealment, which would toll the applicable limitation. Why or why not did Mr. Kosach not get this right?
Because there was no evidence of concealment. If you look back at the arguments on the 50A, and even at the briefing that has been done, the argument that's made by the plaintiff is that a scan that was done on April 25th showed that it may not have been cancerous. And they're saying that they should have done more at that time to determine that it wasn't. That's negligence if they're right. That's not concealment.
Why couldn't that be reasonable diligence, as he argued, under the concealment aspect of the statute?
Well, looking at what was before the court, the evidence that was before the court at the time, we have a scan that says it may not. We have an x-ray of that same date found at Appendix 714 that says metastatic disease cannot be excluded. We have continuing complaints of pain that they are attributing to metastatic disease. We have, on May 2nd, another CT scan that shows another potential spot in her left tibia, I believe, that they were worried about. Maybe that was new cancer. So we have this clinical judgment of these doctors this whole period of time. They don't believe on April 25th, 2002, that she does not have that disease, so they don't believe they've committed an error. There's nothing to conceal at that point. They have
so you believe they exercised reasonable diligence as a matter of law. That's your argument with respect to subparagraph 3.
I'm saying there's no sufficient evidence of concealment. The standard of care issue is totally separate apart, I believe, from that issue.
Well, but we have this odd language in paragraph 3 that says concealment, which is known or through the use of reasonable diligence, should have been known. You're saying there was no sufficient evidence on that latter prong, so that as a matter of law,
that's correct,
that concealment could not be asserted or maintained.
That's correct.
There is an assertion that the doctors in their treatment failed to do a biopsy, which would have dealt with that issue.
Correct.
That go to the standard of care for this reasonableness, reasonable diligence.
That's an allegation of negligence. Ms. Mars was sent for a biopsy to Dr. Kaiser before she even went to see Dr. Schiffenschild. Dr. Schiffenschild don't do biopsies themselves. There's also a record in the appendix, July 2001, I believe, where...
Let's back up. She was sent to this other doctor by the doctors that are being sued, correct?
Schiffenschild's, correct. To Dr. McClish, there was an orthopedic referral at that point, because what we're seeing now, and if you look at the progress reports, they're seeing continued pain complaints. They're treating her, by the way, which is their treatment is intended to cure and...
But again, they are the doctors of care, primary doctors. They made a referral. Did they get anything back from this doctor that they sent her for this biopsy? It was alleged to the court.
Well, there's no evidence here that that did or did not happen. It wasn't presented by the plaintiffs before this court, or as I understand it, I don't know, I can't tell you what happened with Dr. McClish. It is in the progress report that they want to send her. And the reason they want to send her is because they recognize this is a stable disease. They think they're curing her. They don't think they've misdiagnosed her. They think this radiation and this continued treatment is curing her. But she's continuing to complain of pain. She's continuing to exhibit other symptoms consistent with metastatic disease, which they are exploring this entire time. It's not evidence of concealment. They're telling her, if you look at the progress notes, they're telling her, your condition is stable.
Counsel, we're playing with the language, the use of reasonable diligence at this point is what we're looking at, to say, was there enough?
Correct.
Put forth by plaintiffs that... reasonable diligence was not used.
Correct. For purposes of standard of care, that's not for purposes of the exception concealment. There has to be more. There's no evidence these doctors tried to hide anything.
We have a finding that was made by the judge that seems to be a legal finding. And your position is there was not sufficient evidence in the record to support that there was not a use of reasonable diligence.
Sorry, Honor, I think I misunderstood your question.
But what I'm looking at, you have the district court judge made the ruling. He made a ruling that failed to provide any evidence of concealment would toll the applicable limitation period. And the question I have is, did he get it right? Should he have been looking at concealment, as you're saying, operative concealment, or a lack of use of reasonable diligence?
Well, he did get it right, because what you're looking at is, when you look at Section 3, you have to read it in total. Did they conceal an act, error, or omission upon which the action is based? We don't have an act, error, or omission that the doctors were aware of that they concealed from.
Well, as you shorten the sentence, it is based and, it goes on to say, which is known or through the use of reasonable diligence should have been known to the provider of health care.
Correct. And there was no evidence, again, of an act, error, or omission upon which the evidence was based before Dr. Kosach or at the time Dr. Shiffenshield stopped seeing Ms. Mars, that they should have known was an error and that they kept from her. That concealment, this, if you look at the legislative history, this is an equitable tolling doctrine that is, it's so that a wrongful
Counselor,
actor
at
can't
this
benefit.
Point, what we have to look at is the black letter law in front of us.
Correct.
Because quite often the legislature says something in its history, but it's not the total discussion that was before them at the time. We get bits and pieces. Sometimes we get a proper flavor, sometimes it misses. And then what we're left with is what they finally vote on, and we have to take it at the value it's presented to us. And we have to assume that the words mean something.
Okay, and if we do that, if we're looking at an act, error, omission, if that, it was not clearly defined to Judge Kosach by Mr. Sharp and Mr. Osborne, if we're saying it was a misdiagnosis, there's no evidence of a misdiagnosis here. If that is the act, the error, or the omission upon which this case is based, there was no knowledge of that to Dr. Schiff and Shields. There was no
isn't
evidence
it
of that.
Quite simple, in, if you read the statute in almost layman's terms, had they done what they were supposed to do through the use of reasonable diligence, wouldn't they have found out that there was a problem with the diagnoses?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, because if you look even after they stop treating with Dr. Schiff and Shields, they go to Dr. Manos before they go to this other doctor in 2004 that says there's no active evidence of metastatic disease. Again, keeping in mind, Schiff and Shields were treating her. Their whole goal was to get rid of this disease. They thought they were doing that. They thought the radiation and the treatment was getting rid of it. When she goes to see Dr. Manos in March 2003, that's 2 months after she stops seeing Schiff and Shields, she has another bone scan that shows consistent with metastatic disease. There's no evidence that a biopsy or anything else done at this time would have shown that she did not have it when Dr. Schiff and Shields were seeing her. There was no evidence of that presented to
the court. Not at that time, but perhaps in the years preceding when she was undergoing all the treatment, the use of reasonable diligence would have led them to a different conclusion with respect to her condition.
There's no evidence of that, Your Honor. That's pure speculation. And you cannot base a legal finding. It was their burden to prove it at trial, and at the close of their case, they had not proved it. You can look at their expert's testimony, which is provided in the appendix. Neither of the experts say these doctors concealed anything or that they should have known. What they say is, they should have confirmed it with a biopsy. That's the standard of care issue. That's the negligence issue. You have to have something more to toll the statute. And that something more has to be some knowledge on parts of the doctors that they did something wrong and they're trying to hide it. We do not have evidence of that here.
Could you address for me the continuing treatment issue and 2 points in particular? One, was that asserted in the district court? Your brief says not. The plaintiffs say it was. And two, is it correct that other jurisdictions that have recognized that doctrine as a tolling doctrine have statutes that license a court to do that, whereas in Nevada we don't have a statute that does?
Then
I guess the subpart would be, why isn't it a subset of concealment given the broad definition of concealment in subparagraph 3?
Correct. Okay. First of all, if you look at the jurisdictions where the continuing treatment doctrine has been applied by the courts, it's in those jurisdictions that define the statute of limitations as triggering on the date of the malpractice, not on the date of legal injury as it has been defined in Nevada. That's the first prong of that. And actually, excuse me one moment. I have a case here from Maryland. It's a 1985 case, Hill versus Fitzgerald. It's at 501 A. 2nd 27. And this case was interesting, and I pulled it yesterday because what it did is it had applied the continuous treatment doctrine. Then their statute changed. Their legislature did something similar to what we've done, and then they decided it doesn't apply anymore. And their statute is more in line with what ours is today. Does that answer your question? And my other question would be, or my other comment would be, that the legislature did a comprehensive review of all of this when they not only set forth the statute, but when they set forth the exceptions.
My follow-up question, and I apologize to give you
That's
so many,
okay.
Whether or not our particular subparagraph 3 that incorporates this use of reasonable diligence could be seen as somehow embodying the continuing treatment doctrine as a species in effect of concealment, that you're continuing to treat someone and do so without any efficiency.
Looking at it that way, and I think the reason they use the term concealment is because you have to show some knowledge on part of the doctor, some effort to hide this from the party seeking to claim damages as a result of this. There's got to be some effort to prolong the time until they can't bring a claim anymore. In that respect, I can see how it would incorporate to some extent the continuing treatment rule. But even if you look at that and you want to look at those dates as plaintiff, this wasn't argued this directly in the district court, we'll put it that way. But even if you look at that, then you have to take a look at the record and see that she had all her medical records in her hands January 23rd, 2003. So if you want to say, okay, well, they continue to treat her until that time, it should be told until that time, well, then we got to look at, okay, at that point then, she had all the information she needed to know that there was this, well, she knew she didn't have the biopsy all the way back in 2000, but now she has everything that she needs to know to show that these scans showed that it may be benign. If that's the case, discovery starts on January 23rd, 2003, and expires January 2005, which is still 8 months before she files suit.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Sharp, got a few minutes left, 4 minutes and 14 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me address basically 3 points. Because I think they all flow together. And the reason they flow together is based upon the statutory language. First would be with regard to Justice Cherry's comment that physical harm triggers the statute. And I would suggest to you that the Steingart case is perfectly on point, that there needs to be appreciable harm and that there needs to be an effect or a cause of effect in the plaintiff's mind from the medical treatment to the injury. In Steingart, there was physical harm as she continued to have cancer that was misdiagnosed. Here, the physical harm begins at the point that Ms. Mars knows that she does not have metastatic disease. The second point I'd like to address concerns this question of reasonable diligence as provided in subpart 3, and I'd like to correlate that into 2 points. The first point is this. It does not require actual concealment. It requires reasonable diligence and a corresponding failure to act upon the doctor's part. The third page of the handout I gave you is the standard of care that was introduced into evidence, that in order to diagnose metastatic disease, there must be a biopsy. The defense knew there was no biopsy. An endochondroma, which is diagnosed and noted in page 3 on the CT scan, the record before you is an endochondroma is not cancerous. So if there's an endochondroma, there was never metastatic disease. That was exactly what our experts testified to. So the defendants are now put on notice, no biopsy, no cancer. They did nothing. They continued to see Ms. Mars over and over again. So I think the question of reasonable diligence has been proven and certainly a question of fact. Now, I'd like to address as a final point in response to Justice Pickering's questions regarding the continuous treatment rule. And my answer to that question would be twofold. I think by virtue of the use of injury,
you have a form of continuous treatment rule. And I can show you that simply being at my timeline that I produced. When you have, beginning in May of 2000, the treatment due to, for metastatic cancer didn't exist. Then you have, in April of 2002, the physical injury that leads to death. So my rhetorical question is, why is one injury and not the other? But in order to accept the defendant's viewpoint, you have to say, in May of 2000, that was the only injury, even though there were 43 separate treatments, each of which required a separate diagnosis of metastatic disease. So I would say, by virtue of the injury criteria, there is a form of a continuous treatment rule. Secondly, I would agree that the reasonable diligence aspect, especially in the context of a case like this, where you have an ongoing treatment for 4 years, 3 years, of a situation where she is reliant upon their expertise to tell her what the status is of her treatment. And when she's told, you don't have any further signs of cancer, it's all going well, is she supposed to question that? In Hoops versus Ammergren, this court recognized or reaffirmed that the relationship between a patient and a doctor is fiduciary in nature. And I would suggest, in the context of this case, that fiduciary nature relationship has to be considered. And when you have 43 instances of treatment, each of which producing a different injury, or, as our point would be, an injury doesn't occur until September of 2004 when she's told she has no cancer, to say that as a matter of law that the four-year statute begins in May of 2000 and that as a matter of law there was no evidence of concealment due to a failure to act with reasonable diligence, I think at the very least this should be, you know, remanded for a question of fact for the jury. And with that, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to respond.
All right. So in your view, this matter should be resolved simply looking at Hoops and looking at Massey?
I'm sorry?
In your view, this matter could be resolved simply looking at Hoops and Massey?
Absolutely.
Colleagues, any other questions? Okay. Well, thanks. The briefs were excellent. The argument was informative. This matter will stand submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 11:30.